Just to kick off, I'm science editor of the Times. Mark Henderson and I do quite a lot of stuff about personal genomics. I've actually been blogging this week about the fact I've been genotyped. Daniel will explain the difference shortly, by three different companies, and I've been doing a lot of posting on the differences between them. I don't think panelists can use phones at the table for that reason, the obvious reason. I'll turn mine off when I sit down. 10 years ago, 2000, the first draft of the Human Genome Project was completed in a form. And it was not really finished then, but it was nearly finished, and everybody said it was finished. That cost about, the estimates vary, but $3 to $4 billion over an effort of 10 years or more. We're now at a point, the cost of sequencing has fallen so quickly since then, that I think the cheapest genome that's on the market now, if you have a medical condition such as cancer, Illumina will sequence your genome for $9,500. And the actual cost price is lower still than that. It's coming down very quickly within a very short period of time. I certainly expect that the cost of sequencing a genome, an entire genome, will be down below $1,000. Various people, such as Jay Flatley, the chief exec of Illumina, the sequencing company, Francis Collins, the head of the US National Institutes of Health, expect that within 10 years, all of us will have our genome sequenced for medical reasons. And I think what we're here to do today is to explore what the consequences of that are going to be for individuals and, to an extent, for society as well. Issues are, what we hope you're going to go away with today is a better understanding of some of these issues around genomics by looking at the genomes of various people who have been genotyped. So Ed Yong, Martin Robbins, and Claire Ainsworth here on the panel have all had their genes looked at by companies such as 23andMe, where you can pay about $500 or so to have a snapshot. And I'm going to introduce Daniel MacArthur, who is a geneticist at the Sanger Institute, the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, and writes the absolutely unmissable Genetic Future blog for anybody who's interested in this area. Daniel's going to explain Personal Genomics 101. What is genomics?
Thanks very much, Mark. Okay, so I am scheduled to, I think, give a 12-minute introduction to the complex world of genetics. So if I talk too fast or if anything doesn't make sense, please feel free to interrupt or ask questions. So as Mark said, I am wearing two hats in this presentation. The first is, as part of my day job, I work at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, which is a very large genomics facility in Cambridge. And my job there basically is to take human samples. They're fed into the very large machine that is the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, which is basically, it can be simplified just to being a pipeline for taking in samples from various types of DNA sources and then feeding huge amounts of DNA sequence information out the other end. And I've been working on projects such as the Thousand Genomes Project, which seeks to understand human genetic variation. The other hat I'm wearing here is as a blogger, as Mark mentioned. I blog in two places, Genetic Future, and a new group blog, Genomes Unzipped. And in this role, I am, to some extent, I guess, an activist for access for people to genetic information. And I'm actually tremendously excited by what the personal genomics industry is doing. I think that in many ways what this industry is doing is allowing people to get direct access to their genetic information, and in doing so to learn a lot about what genetics means and how complex and messy the whole process can be. But that said, the industry does have some flaws and things that need to be fixed. And I'll hopefully get a chance to talk a little bit about that towards the end. Okay, so today we'll be focusing on direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And the way that basically works is this, and I'll just use a single company, 23andMe, to illustrate that. Consumer goes to the 23andMe website. They order a test kit, in this case for about $500. About a few days later, this fancily packaged box arrives in their mail via FedEx. they spit into a tube. They basically provide, the customer needs to provide about 2 mils of saliva, which doesn't sound like much, but I think some of the panelists can testify. It's quite a bit. It can take some time to work up that amount of spit. You then cap the tube and send it back to 23andMe. You impatiently wait for your results to arrive, and then you get an email somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks later that says that you can then access your genetic information. And all of this genetic information, and it's very complex, as I'll show in a second, can be accessed directly through the 23andMe website. So I wanted to spend a little bit of time at the beginning just spelling out the difference between what a whole genome sequence is versus what these companies offer, which is a genome scan. So let's say we have, I'm not sure how clear that is here, but let's say we have a whole string of A's, C's, G's and T's, which is your genome sequence that you currently don't know. If you were to generate a whole genome sequence, what you would get is the exact letter that's present at each of the 6 billion bases in your genome. So 6 billion letters of DNA. Currently, Mark mentioned it's about $10,000 if you happen to have a disease. The current retail price for most of us mere mortals is about $20,000, so it's a suitcase full of cash at this stage. So out of the reach of most of us, but rapidly dropping in price. So this is something that will be available soon. However, what the tests that we'll be talking about today are what's called genome scans, and these scans only look at a select few, a large number, but still a relatively small proportion of the total genome. So these look at single nucleotide polymorphisms, that is single letter changes, or SNPs we call them, within the genome. And they'll look at somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million of these letters in a single test. And that process will cost somewhere between $500 and $2,000. So you're looking at a very small fraction of the genome, but these SNPs have been selected on the basis of being very commonly variable within humans. So they can actually be quite informative in a number of ways. So in fact, direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies, all the ones that are being talked about today, use the same technology that's being used by research groups around the world to look at the genetic basis of common disease. So these are SNP chips used for genome-wide association studies. So that means that these companies actually test for most of the markers that are also reported in recent cutting-edge academic studies that are doing genome-wide association studies at least. However, what they miss is rare variants, so things that are less common within the population that aren't present on these SNP chips, and also other forms of genetic variation, so large rearrangements and basically anything that's not actually included in those 500,000 to 1 million markers. So in order to access all these other types of genetic variation, all the things that might be, for instance, unique to your genome, you would need to actually get the full sequence. Mm-hmm. So, how accurate are the data that they're presenting? This is Mark Henderson was kind enough to send me his raw data from two separate companies, 23andMe and DecodeMe.
Couldn't get the data from the third one.
We couldn't get the data from Pathway Genomics, and they gave you a very weak explanation as to why that was, actually. But it's
we can come back to that later if we want to. That, I think.
So I looked at the raw data from both of Mark's that was provided by both of these companies. The markers that they use overlap at over 500,000 different positions. And of those 500,000 positions, the companies called exactly the same code at almost all of them. So there were 77 positions overall at which they disagreed. That's actually a little bit higher than previous comparisons, but still, it's a very, very small number. So it translates to an error rate of about 1 in every 14,500 markers. So these tests are actually substantially more accurate than many of the tests that are being used, for instance, in various types of clinical practice, at least on a per SNP, a per marker basis. Okay, so the technology is good. It's used by academic groups, and it's quite accurate. But the question is about the interpretation. What can you actually learn from getting this type of data? So we'll hear more from the panelists, and I just wanted to give a brief scientific introduction to some of the things that tend to pop out from these tests. So one thing these tests are very powerful for exploring is ancestry, and you can see here this is a screenshot from 23andMe showing the genetic clustering of individuals from different parts of the world. Up there in the top left-hand corner are people from Europe, over to the right-hand side are people from East Asia, and down in the bottom there are people from Africa. And both Mark and Ed actually were kind enough to share their genetic data with me. And I haven't actually marked them on this map here, but Mark and I sit up in the boring yellow cluster up on that left-hand side. Ed is comfortably sitting over in the East Asian sector. You can see that despite the fact that humans are very similar genetically, there's enough markers on these chips that you can really get a very good sense as to where someone fits within this pattern of variation So if Ed didn't happen to know that he was East Asian, for instance, and the resolution of these maps is it can actually be astonishingly good, at least in theory. So this map here just shows, this is from a Nature paper from 2 years ago, from people collected from different parts of Europe, the colour-coded by country from the left-hand side. You can see that if you just by clustering them on the basis of their DNA, using exactly the same sort of test that 23andMe uses, you can see they tend to fit within these genetic clusters that correspond to the country in which they were born. So Spain and Portugal, for instance, pop up right down there on the left-hand side, and they're quite distinct from people from Switzerland or France. So these tests are quite powerful in that sense. The other thing they're very good at looking at is patterns of inheritance within families. So these, again, this is real data. This is actually data borrowed from my wife, who has had 23andMe tests done on herself and other members of her family. What you can see here is comparisons of the amount of the sections of the genome that she shares with her mother on the left-hand side, with her sister in the middle, and with me on the right-hand side. And what the colours indicate is the proportion of sharing that occurs at that particular region of the genome. So what she sees is that she is 50% related to her mother at every position in the genome, as you would expect. She is 0% related to me at every position in the genome, which is very reassuring. It means we're not. And you can see this very complex pattern of relationship between her and her sister. It is a complex relationship where she has 50% relatedness at some places and 100% relatedness at others. So you can see this information is a very good way for conveying to people things like the way that genetics works and how genetic information is passed down within families. These tests also can look at the genetic basis of complex traits. They can be very good at some traits in general, although I think we'll hear Claire later that they're not necessarily 100% good in some cases. So things like eye and hair colour, earwax consistency, bizarrely, lactose intolerance, these are all very strongly genetically determined and can be predicted quite well by these tests. Other traits such as body mass, asparagus anosmia, which is the ability to smell asparagus in your own urine, photic sneeze, which is sneezing when you're exposed to sunlight, you'll be surprised to learn these things do actually have very convincing genetic associations. But the amount of the variance that's explained by the 23andMe variance is not strong enough to make a good prediction as yet. We can also... There are disclaimers plastered all over these tests that they're not to be used for medical purposes. Nonetheless, they do report on risk information for a variety of diseases, and there is some utility here. They shouldn't be regarded as clinical tools, but they do actually provide some information. So, for instance, for some complex diseases such as macular degeneration, the common SNPs on these chips do actually... there are some very large effect markers that can be looked at and do have reasonable predictive power. In addition, some of these companies test for serious disease markers such that if you and your partner have the same mutations in the same gene, you carry a 25% risk of disease in your child. None of these should be regarded as clinical grade. So if you're thinking of taking action on the basis of these tests, obviously you need to verify those results first. But in terms of guiding you towards areas that you might be concerned about, they can be quite useful. But there are a number of limitations, and I think these will come out in the next 15 minutes or so. So for instance, the risk scores for most common diseases are not predictive from these tests at all. Things like type 2 diabetes, all of the variants that are genetic variants that are known so far for these diseases have very small effects. So the risk scores that these companies give you really are not yet very highly predictive of your actual probability of getting that disease. More worryingly, the markers and the background risks and some of the prediction algorithms differ between companies, so they can actually give different estimates in some cases for your risk of a disease, and that can be quite worrying and confusing for customers. They don't cover most of the rare variants that are involved in really serious diseases. And also, as I think Ed will point out, the risk predictions are unreliable or non-existent for non-Europeans. And that's not the company's fault. It's basically the fact that there just hasn't yet been enough genetic research done in non-European populations to get good risk scores.
You've got another couple of minutes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, well then I will actually move on to the bigger picture here. So the last week has been a pretty tumultuous time for personal genomics. I'm not sure if we'll have time to talk more about this later, but there's been a very strong and forceful movement. In fact, I think I'd almost characterise it as a pretty vicious movement in the US, both from FDA and from Congress, to move in and regulate these direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies. I mean, it's part of a broader move by the Food and Drug Administration in the US to regulate testing in general within the US. It appears from, there was a Congress hearing yesterday into direct-to-consumer genetic testing, which had an incredibly aggressive tone about it. It looks as though there will be pretty stringent regulation that ends up being added to these companies. The future in the UK in terms of regulation is currently uncertain. There's some guidance from various bodies, but the government, as far as I know, hasn't really made any firm moves in the direction of regulation. In the US, it's possible that they will ban direct-to-consumer products, at least from offering disease risk predictions. They may require clinician involvement. So in other words, before ordering these sort of tests, you may have to go to your doctor as a gatekeeper and ask him for permission to look at your own genome. I think there is a room for very careful regulation in this field. Some of the companies in the area, and I haven't talked about them because all of the companies we're discussing here today are quite responsible. There are companies in the genetic testing space that are far from responsible. There are some genuine scammers, some genuine con artists. There's room for regulation to weed all of those operators out of the field. But if the US moves too heavily to regulate this field, to jump on board and to clamp down on what it sees as dangerous, without necessarily any actual evidence that it's dangerous at this stage, then that will have a long-term effect on the future of genetic medicine. These are companies that are innovating in the field. For instance, 23andMe, I think, presents complex risk predictions in a way that is better than anything I've ever seen from a clinician, anything I've ever seen from anything that's been generated so far from the medical establishment. These companies are generating technologies and ways of looking at complex data that are incredibly important. And I think if they're shut down at this early stage, that will do harm. Yeah. Okay. My view at this stage is that we don't need strong regulation. We really want to open these companies up to more transparency and show that they're basically allow consumers to make an informed choice.
Do you want to show your final slide, the curve, as well?
Yeah,
because that's right. Just okay. Talk to that quickly.
Okay, sure. So very quickly, finally, in terms of what's happening next in the industry, assuming it survives the next few weeks of regulatory upheaval, the future is sequencing, and I'm sure our session sponsor will be pleased to hear me say this. But what we're coming to here is the point where the cost of whole genome sequencing is rapidly dropping in the red line. The information you can actually get from a genome sequence in terms of medically relevant information is increasing at the same time. When the personal genomics industry launched back in early 2008, late 2007, we were much further back in this curve than we are now. And things are really moving to the point that where it's starting to become quite cost-effective to get a genome sequence.
Great.
And I'll finish on that point.
Brilliant. Daniel, thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time. We've got a very tight session, so let's move on quickly. Christine Patch is up next, who is from Guy's Hospital here in London. And Christine is a genetics counsellor, and she will explain to you some of the issues surrounding that.
What I was proposing to do was just put up some slides as pointers, really, and then hopefully there'll be some time for questions, because I wasn't quite sure how to frame this. I regard myself, my role here is to actually present clinical genetics as it is today, which is dealing with people with real medical problems for which we want real validated tests, and they're making really important decisions on the results of those tests, which is not where we are with the DTC companies. I have to say, I do follow your blogs, and I'm astonished to find that I agree with most of everything you've said in your last few slides. Because I think the issue is about transparency. It is about people understanding what they're buying, and it's about them having redress if what they buy harms them or if what they buy misinforms them or leads them to make decisions that aren't realistic. Okay, so this is what genetic counselling is. Essentially, it's a communication process. We're dealing with genetic contributions to disease. We use family histories and medical histories as well as tests. And we offer a limited amount of supportive counselling to support choice and adaptation to risk or actually having a serious condition. I just put this up slide for numbers. This is the UK setting. We only have 23 regional genetic centres, mixed staff in there. In 2008, there were about 253 individuals working under the title genetic counsellor. There's probably about 300 or so medical genetic consultants, so there's actually not that many of us. Anybody can call themselves a genetic counsellor at the moment. Anybody can. We do have a voluntary registration process, and It has been recommended for state regulation by the Health Professions Council in the end of last year. Essentially, most of us come either from a nurse, midwife or health visitor background or have done an MSc in genetic counselling at Cardiff University or Manchester University. So it's a small field with a limited entry. So this is the sort of thing we're dealing with. A young woman comes to us, she's got breast cancer, she's young, she's premenopausal, she has a strong family history. She's also lived through the experience of many relatives dying with breast cancer, the experience of this family that every woman gets breast cancer and every woman dies. What we can do today is assess the family history and on the basis of the family history, offer her targeted screening for the two genes that we currently know about that cause inherited breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2, and we find a mutation. And that has real implications for that family. For herself, it's an explanation for her diagnosis. It may mean that she then goes on to have her ovaries removed, which she might not have done otherwise. It means predictive testing is possible in the rest of the family, so it's possible to test her daughter to see if she's got the mutation. If she hasn't, she's at population risk of getting breast cancer. You can test her sister, who remains at population risk of getting breast cancer. We make a further diagnosis in the cousin over there, who turns out to be a mutation carrier and is entered into a treatment trial. In the future, it will be entry into a different form of treatment. And we identify another mutation carrier who's had no cancer, and we can discuss with her her options, which may be extra screening, it may actually be surgery, which may be ovarian, it may be breast. So serious conditions with serious consequences for those family members if we get it wrong. We do sequencing. This is just to show you what a genetics report looks like. And what I want to pick out there is the methods on there, the actual mutations on there. It's signed off by somebody, and it's done in a CPA as our accreditation in the UK, the laboratories. So it's very clear where the responsibility lies. The accuracy of that report is very clear where the responsibility lies with me as, or my colleagues as a clinician in interpreting that information to the family. So that's the information we have today. Even in that what might seem a relatively simple information, I put this slide up to bring the point. We do use sequencing in the clinic. We use sequencing of targeted areas of the genome in relation to the genes we're interested in. In that sequencing, we will find variants. Some of those variants will be disease-causing. We know they're disease-causing, so we report them as a mutation. Other variants we know are not disease-causing, so we report it as normal. This is a report in 2007 of results from the Myriad database. Myriad are licensed to do genetic testing for, sorry, not licensed, hold the patent on genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 in the States. So all genetic testing in the States for BRCA1 and BRCA2 goes through one lab. 7% of the time in this group, in our practice as well, I don't know what the exact percentage is, you know, somewhere around 7 to 10%, we find what we call a variant of unknown significance. So that's the test is not wrong, it's accurate, it's found a genetic variant. The trouble is we don't know what it means. And we don't know whether it's neutral or it's disease-causing. And we do report those. This is an entry from a blog, just to point out that this kind of uncertain information is incredibly difficult for people to understand. We've had women who've wanted to have preventative breast surgeries, to have their breasts removed on the result of a variant of unknown significance. And it's just incredibly difficult to understand. And that's in a relatively simple situation. It will become resolved over the years as the knowledge develops if the research is done properly. But that's where we are today. So there's an awful lot of confusion in this area, and there's an awful lot of confusion in the D2C and the direct consumer world as well. And I would argue that the companies are, you know, where I have issue with the companies is when they're selling their products as health-related tests. Then it's important that there are quality control standards around their tests. Just information. I have no problem. Somebody wants to go out and pay for the sequence of their gene. It's their right to buy that. But it's when the companies are making false claims about the usefulness of the information they get or actually selling it under a misapprehension that having this test will give you a longer, healthier, happier life, which clearly it won't. So we deal with health-related tests, health-related stuff. We deal with services, not just the analysis. A test is much more than just the analysis of the sequence of letters, or whether you've got a deletion or a duplication. The test is the analysis of that result within the context of the question that's being asked and within the context of other information, which in genetics includes the family structure. There's a huge technology push at the moment, and I think it's really important not to be driven by the boys with their toys. you know, there's a real drive at the moment. This is fantastic. Who's got the best sequencer? Who's got the smallest sequencer? Not the biggest one. But who's got the smallest sequencer that can go faster and produce the most information? Fantastic. Fantastic research tool. It will probably revolutionise laboratory test provision. It's brilliant. But it's really important not to let the technology drive what we're trying to do in the health service, which is answer clinically meaningful questions. In genetics, we deal with traditional genetics. We don't actually yet deal with the whole of medicine, and nor should we, I would argue. That would be the role of the rest of medicine. We're generally dealing with rare inherited disorders or syndromes. We deal with those who have already identified themselves, or the families have been identified at risk, either by the family history or by the virtue of a diagnosis being made. And again, we do targeted tests at the moment. Whole genome sequencing will come into the clinic. I think it's a moot point whether it be the whole genome that then is fed back, or whether it's actually a targeted analysis of that genome that we use in the clinic. So that's just a run through where we are today. And I don't know whether there's time for any questions.
Great. Christian, thank you very much. I tell you what, do people have quick questions for either Daniel or for Christine? Yes, Martin.
Mark, thank you.
Just do wait for the microphone.
Thank you. My name's Martin Ince. That was fascinating, Christian. I just wanted to ask, these are all fairly solid things you've been discussing, like a gene suggestive of the risk of breast cancer, etc. Yeah. What about the fluffier things, like there's quite a lot known now about genetic associations with predilection for addiction? You know, it doesn't have any vast definite predictive outputs, and you might turn into a gambler or into an alcoholic, you know. So rather more intangible kind of things, as we're knowing more about these as time goes on, would you deal with those, or do you think the profession should avoid that?
I think actually you've reached one of the crux of the problem in this area, in that our traditional models have dealt with medical issues. And it's a question of whether that is regarded as a medical issue or not. And that's a huge separate debate. I personally don't want to go anywhere near it. However, if we got accurate risk prediction for the risk of schizophrenia, perhaps I might want to talk with families about what that means for them. So I think actually that's a fundamental... We have a huge confusion in this area. The edges are so blurry and so marginal. We apply a medical model when it's not appropriate, and we also apply a non-medical model, perhaps, when it's not appropriate. So that probably doesn't answer your question, but I don't want to do it.
James, and then Henry, and then we'll probably move on. Quick questions,
very
if we can.
What do you think of the business model of 23andMe? Because I think it's really targeting the worried well, particular demographic and a particular income group within the US predominantly. And the biggest impact from this sort of test would be, of course, doing that on the whole population, as you are doing in your own studies, really understanding what the risk factors for disease. And I'm not clear that this model of making money, of course they can cover their cost of doing the test, but or that the assumed things that they will get this value from knowing lots about their population either will take a very long time to come or may not actually be very useful.
Yeah, we're all right up here, I think.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, great. Okay. So, I mean, I agree. So 23andMe has a curious business model, and I didn't really have much time to go into it here. But, so it's interesting in the sense that it appears that the key business model of 23andMe is collecting genetic data from all of its customers, getting them to fill in surveys, and then looking for new associations. So basically trying to find new genetic variants that are associated with different traits that its customers tell it about. It's totally uncertain at this stage. I mean, they just published a paper recently that showed that this approach can actually work in a number of cases, and fairly trivial cases. So that was things like asparagus anosmia popped up in that study. It's unclear whether that will work for diseases, but they're certainly trying. They've recruited over, I think it's over 4,000 Parkinson's patients, and they'll be looking at them. I don't know whether that model will end up working necessarily very well, but I think we can learn a lot from 23andMe as academic researchers as well. So one thing that 23andMe does phenomenally well is to build up a database of research participants who are actively engaged with their data. So there are 50,000 people total in the 23andMe database. 30,000 of them actually have answered survey questions appear to actually be engaging with their data. So this is a group of individuals who will be reasonably easy for the company to follow up over time. I think academic researchers could really take heed of that If we can come up with ways of returning data to participants in the same way that 23andMe does, we may end up with much better retention rates in our study.
I would just contrast for 1 second with the Kaiser Permanente type databases, in other words, the HMOs in the US, who have vast numbers.
I think we can come back into some of these. Just one thing to add on that as well is I think a key part of the business models of all of these companies is actually the SNP testing, the genotyping, the genome scans that Daniel was talking about is essentially a placeholder technology for sequencing. And I think what they're trying to do is use curious early adopters as a test bed for working out what the best way of actually interpreting and communicating this information is, because actually that's going to be the major challenge going forward. And with the costs of sequencing are falling so fast that I think essentially it will be doing the sequencing will be a commodity technology. It'll be so cheap you will make money out of doing it in bulk. And the real value-added money is going to be interpreting that information. And I think that's where the companies are trying to get at the moment.
Just a point of interest, that 23andMe was founded by the wife of Sergey Brin, who's one of the Google founders, which is a general point of interest.
Henry, do you have a very quick point before we move on?
Policy requirements. Dan spoke about how regulation could stifle innovation, whereas Christine spoke about how registration to be a genetic counsellor is mandatory and anyone can register. Are there any kind of pressing UK policy issues, like if you could go to Andrew Ansley for 5 minutes and say, can you get this done? What would, for either of you, be your key policy UK?
The pressing thing that's happening at the moment is in relation to devices regulation, which is really boring and doesn't make good headlines, but has a major significance. Devices regulation happens through the FDA in the States. It happens through the MHRA, which you're going to be talking about later on, I should think, Alison. Are you at all?
No, the
European IVD directive, in vitro devices directive, is in the process of being reviewed. And part of the driver for that is concern about the direct consumer development. It's very similar to what's happening in the States. And there are possible adverse implications of that in terms of what it means for our NHS laboratories.
Right. Daniel,
I fully agree with Christine. I think that's a crucial issue. Regulators need to be there. There's also this shift in mindset that's going to be required in changing from regulating one test that's done on a patient to regulating whole genome sequencing, which is effectively every genetic test you can imagine being done on that patient. It's going to require very nimble regulators who can keep up with technology. That's a big ask, I think, for regulation.
Great.
But it's not just relation to genetics. I think the fundamental issue is actually we have no mechanisms in place, appropriate mechanisms in place, for regulation of diagnostics and prognostics.
Good point.
That's the crucial question.
Yeah. There's no NICE for diagnostics.
There's no NICE. Well, yeah, they're getting involved.
Yeah. Christine, come sit here. We're now moving on to the exciting part in many ways, which is actually individuals' data. And do people mind if we press forward through the break a bit, because we are running behind because of the overrun in the last one? Obviously, if people want to slip out, do.
Right.
Do you want me to go first, or shall we do the other three first and then I can come back? In which case, shall we go to Claire first, in that case?
Okay. Do I stand up, or...?
As you prefer. We've got some screenshots. Okay. So Claire has been genotyped by 23andMe. And try to keep things
very
brief,
quick.
If
okay.
you can.
I will do.
And then we'll have more time for discussion.
What order are these in? There we go. Okay, I didn't actually sign up to apply for a kit, so I was quite surprised to get an email saying I'd got one. One of the reasons I didn't sign up is because I'm actually quite sceptical about the current value of this testing, given that a lot of these traits are very complex. There's lots of small contributions from lots of different genes, huge amount of input from environment and all that, so I thought, yeah, what's the point? But having been picked, I thought, well, actually, instead of sulking and saying, oh, it's not worth it, I'll have a look and actually see if I can get some insight into the process of being tested and watch, you know, what impact this could have on me. Unlike, I think, Mark and some of the others, I am not going to share all of my data. only a small part of it for a couple of reasons. One of them is obviously you don't know a SNP that looks innocuous these days, you know, what's going to happen to that in the future. But also what's really, going through this process has really brought home to me is that my genetic data is not just my own. I find it ironic that you know, a lot of these companies have me in their names, like 23andMe, DecodeMe. You can put it on Facebook. You know, you can sort of engage it with this whole 21st cult of me. But the things that I find out about me could apply to my family, could have implications for a whole lot of people. So I'm not going to share a lot of it. So I've kind of lost the thread of my argument there. So what did I find out? Well, first of all, being tested, very interesting. I phoned up my parents just to see what their take on it would be before I actually went and did the test. And they live abroad, they're retired, having a whale of a time. So I was actually not entirely convinced that I managed to explain to them very well what exactly they were agreeing to. So again, you know, to what extent do they give their informed consent for me to look in the genome? And in my genome, and perhaps find out things that were distressing or, you know, could impact them in any way. So again, that was another thing that I thought about. What did I find out? Well, the information is very interesting. I found it. I've got a PhD in fly genetics, not population genetics, so I thought I should be able to sort of interpret the data very, very easily. I found it very well presented, but also quite overwhelming. It's a huge amount of stuff there. So what can you learn about me from my genome? Not a lot from what I can see, because a lot of what you've got up here are traits that are supposed to be, that are based on established research. That's what the star rating is. And a lot of the predictions for traits that are supposed to be highly predictable by a genotype are actually completely wrong. So my eye colour is brown. Apparently it's not. I'm grey. Blue-grey. Hair curl, straight hair on average. Well, actually, I've got curly hair. Moving into other sort of areas, I'm supposed to be of medium height, higher BMI and bigger waist circumference, a bit bouncier than I am, actually. So basically, my genome says I'm a sort of more doe-eyed, bouncy, shorter, shinier-haired version of me than I really am, which means I've... my genotype is sexier than my phenotype, which is quite tragic. But, you know, hey. So what else did I find out? Well, in terms of what did I learn that was new about myself, I was interested, actually. I'm interested in trying to stay fit. I've got a limited amount of time to do it, so I'm not very interested in information that can tell me about how I should exercise, how I should get the most out of it. I've already adapted my exercise based on other scientific research, which shows that my body type, which is long limbs with giant paddles on the end, means I'm a good swimmer, so I'm doing more of that. I had a good laugh at the finding that I'm actually a likely sprinter. This means that I carry a variant. That actually means I should have more powerful muscles.
Daniel's team discovered that variant.
Did he?
So it's his fault.
It's your fault. So that was interesting. I discovered that my maternal ancestors came from Iberia. I'm from the H3 haplogroup, which vindicated my support of Spain in the... I'm Scottish originally, so I can't actually support England. So that was good. On a more serious note... Took a couple of minutes. So yes, this is my muscle twitch fibres, and this is how they present the data. They sort of tell you what your genotype is at that SNP. Say I've got one working copy of alpha actinin 3. Many world class sprinters, not me, have this genotype. And the other thing that I'll maybe sort of get down to talk a little bit about is how they explain it, and they talk about things like heritability, which is something I have a heck of a time getting my head around, and this is something that struck me when I went through this. Is that a lot of this, a lot of genetics terms or population genetics terms are actually very hard to get your head around, and I wonder how consumers process that information, decide how reliable that information is, and whether they place too much store in it or not. I'm not going to look at a quick look at my disease risk. Apparently, my risk of age-related macular degeneration is lower. That was quite heartening because I have. I know some members of my family who've had it, so that was interesting to know. What else? That's about it, really.
Great. Thank you, Claire.
Well, let's do Ed next, because Ed's also on the 23andMe platform. Stay there if you haven't got anything. It's probably easier just to stay put.
Okay. So I had an inkling that I was East Asian. I think it was the earwax that gave it away. But the fact that I'm East Asian means that virtually all of my 23andMe results, not all of them, but probably about 95%, are pretty much completely useless to me. And the site itself tells me that for most of the traits, if I actually look at it, it says applicable to European populations, may not apply to other ethnic groups. Now, you can see this if you look at things like hair texture. My results say if you were European, you would have a higher risk of having curlier hair. But I'm not, so I don't. That's a fairly trivial example, but if I look at, say, prostate cancer, the results tell me that I have almost a double the average risk of prostate cancer. That's quite significant, but that applies to European populations. I can select different ethnic groups. I can select African, and bizarrely, there it tells me that I would have a lower risk of prostate cancer based on exactly the same genetic data. There's no option for selecting Asian because that data doesn't exist from large genome-wide association studies. So I can't really interrogate what my data actually tells me in terms of my health risks. There's a huge amount of information there, but it's not particularly applicable. However, a lot of that data will come out from similar studies in the future, so it's sort of an investment. I think over time I'll probably be able to get more information out of this. But in terms of the quality of that information, I think you can't really fault 23andMe for not covering all the bases. If I look at reports for specific disease traits, there's a lot of clarifying information there about what they're actually looking at, what the risk figures actually mean for me. There are things that guard against false assurance or panic and anxiety, but those things are there. A, if you're specifically looking for them and if you read the reports really thoroughly, and I think B, if you're relatively well-educated, because as previously said, a lot of this information is very complicated and has a lot of specific technical jargon behind it. But of course, I think that might be a bit much to expect from people, because when it comes to something as important as your risk of different disease, and some of these are very major and life-threatening, you can't help but get an emotional response. So if I look at, say, the report on carrier status for various genetic conditions, I basically get a long screen that has a large list of diseases and variant absent next to all of them. Now, that feels really reassuring. You just look at it and you go, ah, excellent, I'm not going to get Tay-Sachs and I'm not going to get cystic fibrosis. But then you look at the report and you see that each one of them says, well, we're only really testing for a couple of SNPs for all of these, so the fact that it says variant absent doesn't necessarily mean that you won't get cystic fibrosis and so on. So again, we're in the situation where there's data and you can see you've got a lot of information, but you can't really tell what it actually means for you or what sort of decisions you should make because of it. So I am a bit dubious as to the value of these tests. I think as a sort of exercise in curiosity, it was very interesting. I've written up my experiences more fully on my blog, Not Exactly Rocket Science. a bit shameless, really. Maybe I have a higher risk of shameless plugs.
Do you want to put the URL up, just in case people haven't?
Yeah. You can Google it. Shut up, Martin. Maybe you have a higher risk of butting into people.
Also, just quickly to address Martin's thing, they are starting to provide information on this, on the type of associations that you're talking about. So addiction, for example. My report tells me that I have a higher than average risk of heroin addiction, which I'm not going to
test, really. I don't really think that changes my lifestyle choices in any way.
You can probably see from here I've got new results on leprosy susceptibility, which I also don't intend to test.
Excellent.
Ed, are you nearly wrapped up for time?
Yeah, sure. The other piece of functionality I thought was quite fun was the ability to look at the traits your child would have if you had a child with other people who are on the 23andMe database. So I can, for example, see what would happen if I had a bizarre, freakish love child with either Daniel or Mark here. With Mark, for example, our lovely baby would have wet earwax, apparently.
That's as good a place to move on to Martin as anywhere, I think. So Martin's been done by Navigenics, who's another one of the other companies.
Yeah, so I mean, it's an interesting experience, and you know, genetics isn't my sort of area of research, so I'm not going to talk too much about the science. Although generally, it does sort of underwhelm me a bit, because when I was growing up, you know, Steven Spielberg said they'd be making dinosaurs, and now they just tell you how dry your earwax is going to be, and that's, you know, so not entirely what I thought we'd be doing in 2010. Navigenics, sorry, it's an interesting sort of process. You know, you just go to a website and you hand over your $1,000 and, you know, put your credit card in. Tube comes in the post, you spit in it for a while in front of all your office colleagues who point and laugh for a bit. And then you send it off, and then a week later you get an email and you log into the website and you get what I like to call a wall of death, which is basically this long, long list of things that might kill you and the percentage chance of, you know, which one's going to actually get you. And so you sort of look through that. In my case, I found out that I had quite a high risk of prostate cancer. But fortunately, I'd probably be oblivious to it thanks to my Alzheimer's. But I just found the whole process, you know, I understand where Daniel's coming from. You know, he's a geneticist and he thinks all this is really exciting and it's Brave New World and everyone can, you know, find out what's going to kill them. And I can see the attraction of that for morbid people. But I just found that this whole idea that you can just go on a website, you know, you don't have to phone anyone first, you don't have to speak to anyone first, you don't have anyone there to necessarily interpret the results for you, you just post this off and get this, you know, bunch of stuff that's going to kill you on a screen. I just don't see that there's much either particularly useful on it, because, you know, some of the science is maybe a bit sketchy at times and the risks are maybe presented as being slightly more absolute than they might be. And I just worry about the ethics. I mean, is it really sensible to just dump all this data? I mean, in any other field of medicine, if we have tests done, the tests come back to a doctor and you sit down with the doctor and they interpret the results for you and they can put it across. They understand what it means. They understand what the consequences are. They understand what the risks are. And they're trained at explaining and dealing with those risks to patients. And while I accept that sort of generally, yes, it's good that you have a sort of a right to know what your genome is, I'm not entirely sure that it's necessarily sensible to just be dumping all this kind of diagnostic or sort of pseudo-diagnostic or diagnosis on people without some sort of much more better sort of integrated, you know, process through which you can really have this properly analysed for you by experts. And I think the other interesting thing about this as well, because you get the results over the web, and it comes back to what sort of Claire was saying about, you know, ownership of data. You know, you hand over this sample and they do your genome sequence the scan. And the results are there, and the results are just on the web somewhere, you know, behind a password or whatever. And it strikes me when you look around and you see how often sort of credit card details get nicked from places like Amazon. You know, the idea that my, you know, results are going to be on the internet or on a server connected to the internet for perpetuity is quite worrying. I mean, if somebody hacks into one of those, then who's responsible? What happens to my data? What happens if, you know, future employers, insurance companies, dastardly people, you know, get hold of it? What happens if it ends up, you know, on dating websites and people don't want to sleep with you because they know that your babies are going to have dry earwax? I mean, it's just you know, there's all sorts of ramifications for that. So I accept that it's great that genetics is advancing. It's all really cool and the equipment's brilliant and it's getting smaller and it's getting cheaper and that's all very great. But I you know, I have to say, I did find the process quite sort of worrying. And the websites are just full of caveats. It's like a sort of a monument to weasel words. You know, we've put these percentages up, but they don't necessarily mean anything. Some of them mean something. Some of them might not mean something. We're not really doing, you know, medical diagnoses. We're just you know, presenting the percentage chance that you might get a disease, which is, you know, just, you know. So I was quite uncomfortable with the whole thing. I would do it again, but I really think that sometimes, and I was surprised that Daniel really didn't necessarily seem to get hold of some of those ethical concerns. I mean, it's all very well talking about vicious campaigns by evil regulators, but at the same time, you know, it does slightly concern me how these things would happen. Actually, the other thing as well, the very last point I'll make is that it's interesting is that you're not necessarily just doing this on your behalf, but also, for example, your parents. I mean, I've got a gene that means I've got a 25% risk, supposedly, of getting Alzheimer's one day. Now presumably that's inherited, and so presumably one of my parents has the same thing as well, and of course that's something which, you know, none of them have actually consented to have this test done or anything. So
imagine if you had a twin.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. It's very much the case. So, yeah, it was interesting. I would do it again, but I do have some quite serious concerns. I don't feel that Dan addressed those particularly well when he was talking earlier.
Great. Martin, thank you very much. Just thought I would inject as well some of my experiences with the three different companies, because having been done three ways now, as it were. That was brief, was it? there are some quite significant and interesting differences. And also, so first of all, I mean, I've had my genome scanned now by 23andMe, DecodeMe, and Pathway Genomics, who actually have now got out of a direct-to-consumer business for the time being. They are only providing these tests through a doctor now, but when I did it, it was direct-to-consumer. First of all, the reassuring thing is that with hardly any exceptions at all, the broad bands of risk that they classed me in for overlapping diseases and conditions were the same. There were no cases where one company was saying to me, you've got a very high risk of, say, macular degeneration, and another was saying you've got a low one. There were a couple of small discrepancies, particularly in the drug response areas. So, for example, one company said I was an average metabolizer of warfarin, whereas two said I was a more sensitive metabolizer of warfarin. A couple of other things. If we look at DECODE, well, first of all, if you look at the DECODE health results, which I'm about to show here, and then look at the 23andMe ones, you will see that they are presented in a very similar fashion. So DECODEMe here, you have a list of diseases, you have your relative risk presented there, so abdominal aortic aneurysm, one, so I'm bang on average. And then you have the absolute risk presented in, I think, quite a user-friendly fashion, suggesting of people like you, of people with your genetic type, 17 out of 100 can expect to get this during your lifetime. I think it's quite a sensible, natural frequency-based way of risk presentation that I was quite impressed by. If you look at my 23andMe results, you'll see they're not quite the same, but they are essentially similar in the way that they're presented. So you have here age-related macular degeneration, my risk against average risk. So I think that is quite clearly presented. They do, though, both of these companies put a numerical figure on it. Interestingly, those figures change. I was first genotyped by DecodeMe nearly 3 years ago now, and because new SNPs have been related to certain diseases in the intervening time, you get regular updates on how your risk is changing. Of course, your actual risk isn't changing, but they are able to assess that risk more accurately. So, for example, celiac disease. When I was first genotyped in 2007, I had a relative risk of 2.4, so I was 2.4 times more likely than the general population to get celiac disease. In fact, the background risk of celiac disease is very low, so that wasn't a particularly scary risk. Now, same company calculates my risk at 1.6, my relative risk at 1.6, because of the new SNPs that have emerged. Something else that is worth showing as well. Zoe, can you help me get the pathway slide up? because Pathway Genomics has a very different way of presenting their data. Now, I don't know if you can see that. Can we make that bigger? Yeah. Okay, there we go. So, oops. There we are. So, what Pathway do is, rather than giving you, as DecodeMe and 23andMe do, very clear absolute risks and a numerical value on things, what they do instead is they put you into bands, colour-coded bands, which I can see why they're doing it. They're trying to say, well, this is a fuzzy science. It's very difficult to say you've got a 12% raised risk of this because we don't know what all the variants are yet, and it's intermediate information. So instead of that, what they do here is they put you into the colour-coded band. So as you can see, I've only got one orange band saying take action, which is the highest risk, for exfoliation glaucoma, which is also one of my highest risks on both of the other scans. Incidentally, that's an interesting one because I do know about that from family history already. I do have a family history of glaucoma. However, I wear contact lenses. I have my intraocular pressure checked regularly anyway. My brother and sister don't wear glasses and contact lenses. Therefore, feeding this genetic information to them has actually, I think, made them realise that when they do get to the age when glaucoma potentially becomes a problem, that going for regular eye checks is something that would be very worthwhile to do. This is something that Alison and I have discussed recently, actually, as well, which is that the very idea that actually genetic knowledge, although you can get a very good proxy for it from family history, somehow does hit home to people in a more direct way that I think does tend sometimes to change their behaviour or to... If there is a genetic exceptionalism, which I don't think is necessarily scientifically justified, but it's socially there and is something I think we should think about. I'll stop there. We've got just a little time, if we're happy to run over for a bit, for 5 minutes or so of Q&A now, and then we can have a very quick break and then move on. And I can see Peter Aldous's hand already, followed by Alice.
Do we need a microphone or do we
So I really wanted to address Daniel's question of the balance between regulation and transparency. And I want to do this by telling a story about some of my own experiences. Like Mark, I've been done several ways. I have a Decode account. I have a 23andMe account. I also have some other tests that have been done. But one of the other things that happened is Decode did an offer where you could upload your 23andMe data and they would analyze it. Now, just about in terms of disease risk, the most significant thing you can learn from one of these scans is your genotype for ApoE, and it has a pretty big effect on your risk of Alzheimer's. I know from my Decode data, assuming it's right, and I think the accuracy is pretty good, as we've talked about, that I'm ApoE3, ApoE4. That puts my risk, actual risk, at about twice the average, around about 12, 13% lifetime risk of getting Alzheimer's. And I share that risk with about 20% of a European population. Now, that's when you do it properly. That's when you analyze the two SNPs that are actually in ApoE. You can also do it with it by an imperfect proxy. Navigenics used to do it that way. They've stopped. 23andMe doesn't test both of the SNPs. They only test one. So when Decode uploaded my 23andMe data, what did they do? They did it on the proxy. And the proxy for me is wrong. Decode told me I had a 40% lifetime risk of getting Alzheimer's because they'd assumed from that proxy that I had two copies of ApoE4. I do not. Now, I think that's interesting. I think that's just about as serious as it can get in getting it wrong on one of these scans. Decode got it wrong. They're not scammers. But I just put to you, does that sound like an industry that needs regulating? There was no counselling attached to that. I I'm pretty well informed about this stuff, but if I'd have been a average 23andMe customer and uploaded that data and got that information, and there's no information on Alzheimer's in the 23andMe scan, I think that would have been a devastating thing to learn. It was completely wrong. So, and just transparency. Now, what has Decode's response to that been? Pretty much they've shut me down. I've run a number of stories looking at glitches with things they've done. They don't respond to me anymore. So are we going to get transparency? I mean, it's not, oh, Peter, let's work with you, let's communicate better. It's, let's not respond to this guy because he's a troublemaker, I think, is their response. I mean, if there's anybody here and they want to dispute that, that's fine.
Just before Daniel comes in, I've had some experience of raising issues with companies as well, and I've found them more receptive than you to actually saying, actually, you're right, that is something we need to communicate better, let's evolve. But
they have changed it subsequently. They just removed the Alzheimer's thing from there, and there's now stuff on the website saying that that proxy isn't good.
Right. Daniel, do you want to reply to that?
So the issue that Peter's talking about, it was kind of an interesting case. So that was a case where we had one company, Decode, that was trying to run its analysis pipeline on data that had been generated by another company, 23andMe. And there were a number of problems that occurred during that transition. This was a limited offer that they launched. And I agree, it was a terrible error, and it shouldn't have been made. The company should have been better prepared for uploading data. In this case, it could have caused some serious problems if someone had seen that too early and had responded to that inappropriately. And I'm not against some forms of regulation to encourage companies to ensure that their analysis algorithms are actually robust, and also that they're similar between companies. I mean, we shouldn't be seeing these levels of differences between the interpretations from different companies. I think there is room for careful regulation there. Where I guess perhaps I was a bit excessive in the way I presented things. I'm against regulation that will really clamp down on the industry and prevent them from giving you information that I think consumers want. I'm not against very careful regulation that makes sure they do it responsibly.
Just before asking Christine here, I think one of the points on that is, in some ways, the most interesting number on this slide is my lab number at the top corner, which is 1,019. I had this test done in end of March, beginning of April, and Pathway had been running for nearly a year by then. It gives you an idea of how few customers they have at the moment.
Can I just make a very quick point just in reply to that?
Yes, and then Christine, and then we'll have Alice's question, and then we'll move on.
It's just sort of to follow up what he said. I mean, because my risk of Alzheimer's from Navigenics was 25%, which is fairly substantially higher. It's 1 in 4 risk. And it's just sort of just picking you up on this again, because it's all very well saying, oh yeah, we want to get the algorithms better and make sure that the information's right, but you've still not addressed the facts that companies are telling people that they have a 1 in 4 risk or a 1 in 2 risk of getting Alzheimer's in the first place without any medical professional being involved in that dialogue at all. You just, you know, do your credit card on the internet, get the result back, bang, oh yeah, you're probably going to get Alzheimer's. You know, do you not accept that there is at least some argument for saying that there should be some kind of regulation on how those results are handed out, rather than now where it's just printed on your wall of death on the website?
There's a balance here. So on the one hand, we do want to make sure that consumers aren't harmed by this information. On the other hand, we don't want to clamp down on something unnecessarily. So it's actually surprising. There's not much literature out there yet on the way that people do respond to genetic test results. But the information that exists suggests that people who receive positive test results for reasonably serious conditions, it doesn't actually cause serious emotional damage. There's a lot more research that needs to be done on this. But for instance, there was a study done recently called the REVEAL study that looked at people's response to Alzheimer's testing. And again, the response there was that people who received a positive test for these variants in general didn't suffer long-term harm. And there was, in fact, some positive outcomes for people who...
I think we can come back to that issue when Alison gives her presentation later. Christine wanted to come in here.
Just very briefly to raise another issue. Of course, we don't use the ApoE test clinically to predict risk of Alzheimer's because it's not... It gives an increased risk, and the evidence is valid, but it's not sufficiently increased to be clinically useful, and there's nothing you can do about it, and we just wouldn't do it clinically. to give Alzheimer's drug. The REVEAL study was a selected population, higher risk, I think, or maybe not, maybe population, but it was given in the context of a clinical consultation with advice. It wasn't just, I'll press the button, and there's another button which says, don't press this unless you want to know.
Yeah.
You press it and you find
it. I agree with this. I'm clearly huge, and there are research projects going on now to look at responses to direct consumer information. I'm looking forward to seeing what they say.
Yeah.
I just wanted to very quickly actually also point out, it's not just emotional damage that people risk by this. I mean, when I looked at my 23andMe results, I was quite alarmed to see that without any sort of you don't have to click through anything to see a whole bank of monogenic disorder results. And of course, you know, if you picked up on one of those, maybe, you know, I don't have the BRCA1 mutation, but I could have learned just bang straight up that I had it.
Actually, there's a bigger issue there too, which is with BRCA, with the BRCA1 mutation, they only test 23andMe for a very few number of mutations within it.
So
you could get a false all clear.
But also, you know, would I have to disclose it on health insurance applications, and what does it mean? What would it mean for other family members? Because not all of these monogenic traits are fully recessive as well. So while I support the idea of openness and access to your own genome, I think the idea that, you know, you should have complete unfettered access to your own information, given that it impacts other people as well, is debatable.
Can we move on? We had two very quick things, Natasha and Alice. Shall we take both, and then we'll get very quick response?
I actually think for the kind of genetic revolution that's happening, we can't rely on the doctors, just because we cannot all turn up at our doctors and ask for information. So I think we need to just cut the doctors out of the question. Has anyone turned up with the genetic data from their doctor and said, can you help me interpret this? No, of course they haven't. So we need a more complicated solution, I think, than just saying, well, we need doctors involved. So we just need to ask the companies themselves to perhaps do this differently. That's all we can do.
Alice?
My question's on social media, and it's got two points, but I'll try and be brief because I know we're pressed for time. The first one was that I noticed, as Martin was talking about security issues, about information, Mark was flashing up some of his slides, and right behind him was something that linked into Facebook, which I thought was very interesting, and I wondered if you could tell me how that worked. And maybe linked to this or separate, is that I was thinking about Ed talking about how you could find out about children with other 23andMe users, and that sense of community that's clearly trying to be fostered by that. So is there this... Well, the bigger point is maybe the big sci-fi question about genetic technology, which is that it allows particular people who can afford access to this stuff. It's consumer genetics. It does open up the data, but it opens up to a certain number, only a group of people, the people who can afford it. So is it sort of, you know, fostering this community of people who use this, who can have access to it, and then there's going to be people left behind? And I just was surprised that class issue maybe, or access and financial issue, wasn't really mentioned.
I think certainly at the moment that's definitely the case. It's only for those who are very curious and can afford it. I guess going forward, one would imagine that if the benefits prove worthwhile, it will be something that will be provided by the NHS or health insurers where it is. If you're talking about global equity, yes, there's a bigger issue there.
And I guess if they're using the data to do research, would this not bias your sample in favour of...
Well, I think that's a big criticism of the 23andMe research approach. Daniel?
Oh, in the sense that it is a biased sample. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, 23andMe, they have engaged in some efforts to recruit people from other minority backgrounds and so on. But it is a simple fact that most of the people in their database are middle-class white Americans.
Yeah. And Christine, in relation to Natasha's question, isn't one of the issues here as well that we have quite a shortage of genetic counsellors?
I actually struggle with this, because I think if the information is clinically useful, then we should be using it clinically. I don't think the information is clinically useful. I think the clinically useful information that's being generated should be being used in a clinical setting, whether that's, you know, however that's provided. I think one of the issue is that, A, there aren't enough genetic counsellors, that actually genetic counsellors we don't deal with common diseases. You know, the model of our practice and our preparation and our training is for the single gene, highly inheritable diseases. In a sense, a bad test is not made better by just being nice about it, you know. And I think there is a danger in saying, and I agree, I feel that as well with the, say, for example, in the Germany and Austrian move and France, where you can't have a genetic test without a doctor. But actually, it doesn't say anything about the quality of that doctor's ability to interpret the information. In my our practice, we are very often, sadly, seeing people referred who've been given the wrong information by their doctors because they're not genetic specialists.
I think that's probably a good place to move on. If anybody wants a quick break, they're welcome to, but I think we'll probably keep... Should we take 2 minutes to change panel? We're changing panel anyway, so...